Hello and welcome to the Carly Created Content Committee podcast. We're your hosts.
Anne Elizabeth Shelley, Music and Multimedia Services Librarian at Illinois State University.
And Paul Goh, System Librarian at Illinois Institute of Technology. This podcast is a product of the Carly Created Content Committee and is the first in a series of podcasts intended to highlight or showcase things of interest to those involved in digital projects in libraries, archives, museums, and related fields. Carly is the Consortium of Academic and Research Libraries in Illinois. More information about Carly and its committees can be found at www.carli.illinois.edu. That's www.carli.illinois.edu.
Today on this podcast, we're interviewing two key players in the Digital Power Project. Power is spelled P-O-W-R-R, and these folks are Jamie Schumacher and Lynn Thomas. And Jamie and Lynn, could you please introduce yourselves?
Certainly. My name is Lynn Thomas. I'm the curator of rare books and special collections at Northern Illinois University, and I'm one of the co-primary investigators on the Institute for Museum and Library Services grant, which became the Digital Power Project.
And I am Jamie Schumacher, and I am the director of the Digital Power Project, and that is the whole of my job responsibility right now, is keeping this thing alive and working.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for being with us today for this podcast. And just for the folks listening, more information about the Digital Power Project can be found at digitalpower.niu.edu. All right, and let's get started with our first question on this interview. Jamie and Lynn, can you tell us a little bit more about the Power Project? More specifically, what are its near-term goals and what are its long-term goals?
Well, the near-term goals have to do with finding ways to do digital preservation when you don't have enough money or enough staff. They came out of an actual immediate need on our campus that we realized back in 2008 when we didn't get an NEH grant that we had applied for, specifically because we didn't have a plan for the longevity of any materials we had digitized. We realized that this was not going to be a problem that would happen just to us, and so we put together a team of people and found colleagues across the state at four other institutions, at Illinois Wesleyan, at Illinois State, at Chicago State, and at Western Illinois, and we all got together and tried to figure out what, in an ideal world, a digital preservation setup for our institutions might look like, especially if we shared and played well together. And we submitted that as an implementation grant to the IMLS, and they came back to us and said, this is a great idea. You've identified a real problem with smaller institutions and lack of resources, but we don't think your plan will actually work. So here's half the money that you asked for and 2 years to figure out a better plan. And then the first thing we did was hire Jamie to help us figure out a plan. So Jamie, do you want to talk a little more about the longer-term goals?
Sure. Once we got started and we realized that obviously we were not alone in this digital preservation conundrum, we decided that what we really needed to do was remove some barriers for getting started and offering some friendly nudges to our colleagues out there and posting lots of signage along the path. And we figured out that there's going to be more than one path on the road to successful digital preservation. So we started figuring out what activities we could do to remove barriers and figuring out the best way to get the word out that yes, this can be done, we are here to help you, and here are some things that you can do to get started. I think our long-term goals, we're wrapping up our study right now of the actual digital preservation tools and services that we're testing, And our long-term goals are getting this white paper written and out there so that people can read about our findings, but educating, going on the road, showing people how they can get started on their campuses. I think that's really the long-term goal.
Well, that and actually, you know, solving the digital preservation problems on our campuses.
That's great. You've already answered some of this in your previous response, but can you tell us more about yourself and your member institutions, what brought you together for this project, and how did you secure the grant?
In a little more specifics, the way that it worked was that when we didn't get the NEH grant that we applied for back in 2008, we contacted Carly because we had looked at digital preservation options, and most of what we were seeing were collaborative projects of some kind. I had previously served on the preservation working group for Carly, and we had produced a white paper back in 2006 that had talked about the need for digital preservation throughout the consortium, but the Carly board basically had come to the conclusion that they didn't have the resources to do a whole lot at that point. So what we decided was that if Carly didn't have the resources to deal with it, perhaps we should try to sort of do for ourselves. So we contacted Carly to see if they would just give us a space in which to meet, and we made an open call. We had done with that white paper for Carly for the Preservation Working Group a survey of library directors across Carly, and we did a call to any institution that was interested in trying to apply for a grant to solve the problem. We had participants from about 10 or 12 institutions that ended up being able to actually make the meeting that we set. And out of those 10 institutions, we got down to 4 that were able to, when we sat down and sort of hashed out back of the envelope math of what we thought it might cost, that they felt were able to provide sufficient cost share to make up for the amount of money we would need to ask for, because IMLS grants are set up for cost share, where they give you, in our case, $575,000, and it's our job to match that with essentially labor and resources from our institutions. So it's not necessarily cold, hard cash that is being matched. Most of it has been through the salaries of people who are working on the project. A percentage of our time goes towards the cost share. But that's how we ended up with our final 4. They were the ones that felt that they could match the amount of sort of divvied up cost share that we had figured out in that one meeting with back of the envelope math. And we spent a lot of time over the next 6 months or so locking ourselves in rooms and being smart and trying to figure something out. And that included a very active rewrite at the very last minute. The IMLS contacted us we had submitted the application in February. They contacted my co-PI, Drew Vandercreek, and I in August and said, okay, we love your idea. We think you've identified a problem, but we can't give you the amount of money that you want because we don't think your plan will work. We're going to have you change the whole grant into a study. Here's the target amount we think we can give you that's reasonable for a study. We basically, Drew and I had to rewrite the whole grant over a weekend. So that was really fun, but we managed it. And you know, this grant, in our experience, has been a whole lot of making stuff up as we go along. But that's not necessarily a bad thing, because what we've learned as we've studied what people are doing, how things are working in digital preservation right now, and how people are working together, is that the vast majority of people are actually making it up as they go along, and that's okay.
So you mentioned that there were several institutions who were involved in this project. Can you talk about integrating each institution's unique needs or expectations in the project? You know, was that difficult? Not as difficult as you thought? I'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
Sure. In addition to the project partners here at Northern Illinois University, we have project partners, as Lynn mentioned, from Chicago State, Illinois Wesleyan, Illinois State, and Western Illinois. And the beauty of having 5 different partner institutions working at this is that we didn't necessarily want to integrate. We wanted to hack at it with our own unique set of challenges and advantages. So we would all agree to test the same tools and services. We would coordinate our testing. We would use the same types of evaluation forms, but we would use our own data sets and try to work through our own challenges at each of our institutions. And we're really pleased with the outcome because now we have 5 different institutions that can talk about how they believe digital preservation can work given their unique set of circumstances. And we feel like that's really going to be valuable to people out there because they'll be able to essentially map, take a look at what the partner institutions look like from the Power Grant and say, yeah, I look a lot like this institution. I'm a private liberal arts college. I have some funding, but I really don't have much IT support and very few staff. So I'm going to be a lot like an Illinois Wesleyan, and this is the type of solution that Illinois Wesleyan thinks may work for them as a result of the study.
Okay, great. How has this process been working for you? Has it led to a feeling that digital preservation is more attainable, or has it become more daunting over time?
I think the base answer to that is yes. What we found is that it depends on where you set your goalposts. What we've determined is that good enough digital preservation, the kind of work that will get our that will make our stuff safe for the next 5 to 10 years at most of our institutions is totally plausible. Making a 25-year plan, not so much. But doing 5 to 10 years worth of digital preservation work means that in 5 to 10 years we can revisit it, look at the next round of technologies, which will of course have changed completely in the meantime, and make the next step. So what we're actually learning is that, especially when you don't have a lot of resources, whether it's IT resources, whether it's people resources, whether it's cash money resources, good enough is okay for now. And it's better to do something with good enough digital preservation than to not do anything in search of trying to get to perfect. Because not doing anything is going to be worse for your materials than doing a little something that's good enough for now.
And I think, too, as we are researching digital preservation and as our colleagues out there in the library and archives world do perhaps a Google search of digital preservation, they get these scary things like the OAIS diagram and things about track certification, and it is completely overwhelming, and we were completely overwhelmed as well when we first started looking at this big thing that needed to be done that's very complicated, and oh my gosh, how am I even going to start? What we have found in the process of this study is that the first few steps that you need to take to get started are a lot easier than you think.
So, Jamie, your last comment leads in really nicely to questions a little further down our agenda. Can you talk about some of the best first steps for an institution that has limited resources that wants to get into digital preservation?
Sure. I think the very first step that someone at a smaller organization needs to take in order to achieve their digital preservation goals is to have a conversation with somebody you already know, somebody at your campus or in your archive that you know is also dealing with digital stuff. Have a conversation with them and say, gosh, you know, this is something that we need to be thinking about. And start building your team, because the big thing I think all of the partners on this project has learned is that you cannot go at this alone. It will not work, and it's frankly too overwhelming. So the first step is to have a conversation with someone at your institution and get them on board with the idea. And this is somebody that you already have a relationship with. It could be somebody in IT, it could be an administrator, it could be a colleague, but that's the first thing you can do. And having a conversation really isn't that hard. And one of the things that we've done on this project is provide materials, sort of conversation starters, to help you identify who you might talk to and how to talk to them, how to address the problem of digital preservation in a way that they understand. Talking to digital preservation to, say, an IT person isn't going to work unless you speak their language. To them, they think of backup and tapes. And a lot of us in the library and archives world know that digital preservation is a lot more than that. So we've provided materials that are going to help you have that first conversation. I think another good next step is just to take an inventory of what you already have. And we're talking a very simple inventory of perhaps five different
descriptors,
thank you, Lynn, about what you have. Because once you identify what you have, it's going to be a lot easier to make the case to your administrator, because you can say, hey, this is what we have. This is at risk if we don't do something about this digital preservation problem.
Great. In this process, have you identified any tools that are you found to be valuable, and why are they valuable?
Well, at the risk of giving away lots of spoilers for our white paper, we did actually find quite a few tools. One of the things that we produced, which you can find on our website, is a tool grid. Because one of the things that we discovered, when you Google the phrase digital preservation tools, you get something like 500 million hits. And the reason for that is that digital preservation as a field has been in flux for quite some time. It is constantly changing. And there are two different models of tools that exist in digital preservation land. There are sort of microservices and there are macro services. And when I say microservices, I mean little bits of software that do one specific thing, or maybe two specific things. Macroservices take all of those little specific things and put them together in a more comprehensive software package, the kind of thing that you typically see from a really robust program that you might get from a vendor or from an open source thing that has been more developed over time through lots of grant funding. So what we've put together is we've looked at about 60 tools, just over 60 tools, and we mapped them to a grid that matches up with the OAIS reference model and the digital curation lifecycle. So the idea is that if you're looking to do specific things, like if you just want to make sure that you can do a fixity check on something, there's probably 20 or 30 different tools that could do that, and you can find all of them on our grid in the ingest section. If you're looking for something that handles rights management, there may be several tools that do that, but they may or may not be tied to the same tool that does fixity checks. So you can sort of go through the grid and find the functions you want, and then see the pieces of software that do it. We also have a group of material of tools and services that we have been testing more intensively, because we thought, after consulting with our advisors on the project, we have a group of six advisors who are experts in digital preservation at larger institutions. Their whole job is to get locked into a room with us periodically and to say, no, that's a dumb idea, it will take you forever, or yes, do that, that's a good plan. And they've been really wonderful for us, because they have graciously allowed us to learn from their mistakes and to make a few of our own, but to do so in ways that have been really productive. So the softwares that we have and services that we have been testing slightly more intensively, generally we sort of do the divide and conquer method, where people kind of dibs what things they're going to play with, and then we all fill out the same form. Because when you are in the aggregate between our five institutions, there's something like 35 people on the project. So what that means is that we can, you know, individually, someone says, I can spend an hour testing this piece of software, instead of one person having to spend 35 hours. So it sort of divides up nicely. The ones that we're looking at most closely and we'll be talking about in our report are Archivematica, Curators Workbench, DuraCloud, Internet Archive, MetaArchive, and Preservica. Now, some of those are things like cloud storage services. Some of those are processing software that allow you to wrangle your metadata on the front end. Some of them are comprehensive sort of turnkey solutions that do everything from soup to nuts, or you can access different parts of them for different pricing. There are lots of different ways to go in digital preservation, and what we found is that not a single tool is going to solve every problem. Most of us will end up using some sort of combination of tools and services to solve our local needs. And that makes things complicated because, of course, that means you have to sort out how many tools and services you can use, what you can support, which things you need to partner with people on, and which things you can do yourself. So it's really complicated is the short version.
Great, thank you. So as a follow-up to your description about the tools and services grid or list that's on the project site, can you say if this list is going to be dynamic? Will it be updated as new features or services emerge? Or is it meant to be a little bit more static than that?
Since this is a grant-funded project and we run out of money and time at the end of this year, we built this as a tool to use right now, and the response to it has been so great. It's been very well received. I think people really like the idea of being able to look at a glance at all the digital preservation tools and services out there and what functionality they perform within the life cycle. Very shortly after we put this out on the web, we were contacted by some folks in the UK who said, this is great. We want to build a community-owned digital preservation tool registry that will be owned and updated by the community, hopefully to infinity, and that we would like to basically feed what updates they get into our tool registry. So while that's not currently happening, we are working on developing essentially a plugin that will take all the updates that are happening on this community-owned registry and feed them into this more visual graphic layout so that it's easier for people to kind of see what they need at a glance. We have been updating it occasionally as the project goes on, especially as we get poked from people out there that are developing tools, saying, hey, I have this new tool, can you throw it up there? We're happy to do that, and we have been actively doing that. But the idea is for eventually for the grid to be owned by the community and updated by the people who are actively trying to do digital preservation.
That's fantastic. We also noticed that from a poster session that we saw of yours, that you're working with the NDSA, Meta Archive Cooperative, and Copter. Can you tell us a little more about these and what advantages they have for a resource-limited institution?
Sure, absolutely. I'll start with the Copter. That's actually what I was just referencing. A Copter stands for Community-Owned Preservation Tool Registry. And that is currently stewarded by some folks out of the UK, and it has been the idea of it has been bought into by the Library of Congress, the Digital Curation Center, and several other larger organizations that have in the past hosted digital preservation tool registries. Paul Wheatley over in the UK had the idea of, let's create one registry to rule them all, so that when you're looking for tools, there is one place to go to find the most updated version instead of 20. So he was the one that actually contacted us and asked if we would be willing to work with him and to integrate the two. And that is currently a work in progress, and you can go to their website. If you just Google COPTR, that will take you straight to Copter, and you will see Digital Power's name on the project as well as being a supporting partner. With the NDSA, that stands for the National Digital Stewardship Alliance. And one of the original goals of the project was to figure out how smaller and medium-sized institutions could join the NDSA, which is stewarded by the Library of Congress and has members currently like Harvard, Stanford, the San Diego Supercomputing Center. So not necessarily smaller and less resourced institutions, but there's a body of knowledge of there that could prove incredibly beneficial to smaller institutions as they're developing their burgeoning digital preservation programs. So we did what anyone would do, and we showed up at the Library of Congress's front door and we said, hey, we want to play. And they welcomed us in and said, okay, here are some things that we could do. We found out that they do accept free of charge any member who is trying to perform digital preservation activities. What you need to commit to is working on one of their subgroups, like we're speaking right now with the content group. The NDSA also has their own content working group. They have an outreach group. They have a technical infrastructure group. So the idea is for you to give a little bit of your time to make progress on the digital preservation profession as a whole. And one of the things that we're doing is we're going to be co-hosting NDSA regional meetings with Power workshops. And what that means is the Power Project is going to be putting on workshops for the rest of this year that basically gives practitioners, it's a one-day workshop, it gives them hands-on experience with some digital preservation tools and helps them better understand how those tools might fit into their institution's workflow. The idea is to have members of the NDSA who are in the region meet up together to talk about the projects they're working on, and then to give an opportunity for the workshop attendees to meet and network with the members of the NDSA that are in their region, get some face-to-face time with them, create some connections that you'll be able to use as you're developing your digital preservation program, and then potentially join the NDSA if you feel like that's a good fit for your institution. Finally, the MetaArchive Cooperative. MetaArchive is a private locks network that we are investigating as a project team as a back-end digital preservation solution. One of the options that MetaArchive offers is a collaborative membership where there is one lead institution and however many smaller institutions that connect together. The smaller institutions feed their digital objects to the lead institution that MetaArchive then takes and preserves for the long term. This provides opportunities for smaller organizations that may have limited technical infrastructures and can't support being members themselves, and it also provides economies of scale for those with smaller budgets. We found that a barrier to entry for organizations looking to join that way is that there was the only possible way you could really do it is if you did it as a consortium. And a lot of consortiums aren't prepared to join something like MetaArchive. So what we are doing is the Power Project has hired someone to create all of the documentation and the legal framework that you would need to join up as a group, as a collaborative, to then use a digital preservation service like MetaArchive as a group.
Well, I think that brings us to the end of our list of questions, and thank you so much, Jamie and Lynn, for your time today. You shared some really wonderful information about the Digital Power Project and digital preservation in general, and we really appreciate your time. Before we sign off, is there anything else that you'd like to share about the project?
Yeah, if you go to our website, we're going to start posting dates of workshops that we're going to be holding throughout the state of Illinois and, of course, nationally. And these workshops that we're going to provide, these are the one-day workshops where get your hands dirty, get in there, figure out what these tools do and how they might work at your institution. We're going to come to you, and we're going to be providing these either free of charge or perhaps just the cost of a boxed lunch. But the idea is to get as many people as are interested in the door to get some hands-on experience and spend a day just learning about the tools and how they might fit into the workflow and how they can begin to take these first steps of creating a policy by having conversations and reaching out to other people on their campuses. So I would say just go to our website. There's a ton of information for you there, and always feel free to reach out to us and let us know if there's something else you might need.
We also want to encourage people to check out our wiki. One of the things that we have been doing is that all of our working papers, every case study that we have conducted, all of our materials as we have gone through the project are all posted to our wiki. Everything is public. We determined that the best way to function as a group was to do digital preservation in public without a net. So if you want to see what our experiences look like, there is a metric ton of documentation, everything from minutes from meetings to mock-ups of our posters and everything that we have created or worked on through this project is on our wiki. So go learn from our pain and make use of the stuff that we've put out there, because that's why we did it in public. We want people to use it. It's all there to be used and shared and remixed and made use of.
Wonderful. Thanks again for all this great information. This has been a Carly Created Content Committee podcast. You can find out more about Carly at www.carli.illinois.edu. You can find many of Carly's digital collections at collections.carli.illinois.edu. Thanks so much for listening. This is Ann Shelley signing off, and my co-host,
Paul Go.
And we'll see you next time on the Carly Created Content Committee podcast.
Thank you very much.